So hey everybody, welcome. This is Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. I'm in the studio with Pete White. Pete is the director or co-director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network. He's doing pretty amazing work both in Skid Row and in South LA that I'll tell you about. He's been fighting the police and their attacks on homeless, mainly black people in Skid Row. And I just came off a very interesting webinar that he was very nice enough to invite me on, where we started having a long conversation about gun control, stand your ground laws, Trayvon Martin, the National Rifle Association. And basically, what are we going to do about the fact that one basic argument is that there is, in fact, not an increase in violent crime in black and Latino communities, but there is an increase in police crime and police violence. But how do we shape the issue? What kind of demands do we place on the system? So let's begin. Pete, very nice to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Eric. I always enjoy being here.
Well, let's get right to the webinar. We'll come back to some of your background later. Why'd you organize the webinar? Who was on it? Tell us about the Black Men and Boys 2025.
Yeah, so right after Hurricane Katrina, the 21st Century Foundation, which was at that time the oldest African-American foundation, brought together organizers from across the country to have a conversation about what we saw in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. And it became very crystal clear that while the storm had rushed to the shores of Louisiana, what it revealed was a condition of African-Americans across the country. And so the storm just peeled back a layer to give us a very clear preview of the violence of poverty, which finds itself in many black and brown communities, quite frankly. From that initial gathering of leaders from Chicago, from New York, from Philadelphia, from New Orleans, from Oakland, from D.C., from the chocolate cities around the country, we developed a framework called We Dream of World 2025. And what the framework was intent on doing was to have a blueprint or a playbook, if you will, that could change the health outcomes of children born in 2006 at that time, have to ensure that black communities were thriving by 2025. One of the issues that came up at that time was the issue of interpersonal violence in the black community. It's a question that we have continued to grapple with as a network. As you said earlier, when you got on the when we started the show today, crime over the last 15, 20 years, violent crime, has plummeted, right? But the resources going toward the police department has steadily increased.
Let me ask you just to start with this, that was the goal of the foundation to focus on violence inside the community or violence against the community? What was its focus?
So the focus of the foundation, it was deeply rooted in King's ideology. And so from the outset, when we looked at violence, we clearly understood that the greatest form of violence, borrowing from the great Reverend Doctor, suffered by the Negro, as he said it in 1964, was the violence of poverty. And so for us, it was always a structural conversation. We didn't start at a space where we were talking about interpersonal violence. We were talking about systems failure and structural failure and what were the byproducts of that system's failure. And so, and as you know, or what were the symptoms? And as you know, one of the symptoms, one of the greatest predictors of violence in poor communities is poverty.
Well, let's even move fast forward to today, because I'm going to get to some of my opinions in a minute. But one of the things I'm looking for, Pete, is what are some of the structural demands now that you're thinking about? Because we know there's police violence. We know there's, as you said, the racist poverty of violence. My mind quickly goes, as yours does, to demand development. What are we going to ask the system to do? Let me just put a card on my table that I'd like you to think about. I was there when the so-called war on poverty was initiated, and we actually had a little hope. Even though we thought the system was totally corrupt, I was there when is hundreds and hundreds of black people, because they said, we want you to participate in the maximum feasible participation of the poor. And people actually for a moment took that seriously. So they all started lining up saying, all right, I'll tell you what you got to do. You got to get rid of my slumlord. You got to get rid of the mayor. You got to get rid of the fire department. You got to get rid, you have to change this. You have to change. I need a job. I need income. They knew exactly what they wanted the government to do. And the government said, that's the end of this poverty program. Really, that these demands that you're asking for are so structural that capitalism can, I thought you were going to just maximum feasible participation in the poor. You're just going to sort of participate. But I was really struck by how much, if you asked poor black people what they wanted, they had a vision way beyond themselves. And they really wanted change for the whole community, even for the whole society. So given that hope 50 years ago, 45 years ago, you're now working in a war against the poor. What's changed in your mind about what are we going to ask the system to do?
I mean, I don't think we can ask the system to do anything. Right. I think what's very instructive in your example and what we know now, anytime this government comes and says it's about to wage a domestic war, a right. war on poverty, a war on drugs, our communities know intuitively that that is going to be a war on their communities, a war on their family, a war in the form of gang injunctions, a war in the form of racial profiling, stop and frisk, a war in the form of asset stripping or taking away any potential that young men and women of color might have to potentially move forward. And so I believe that we know all too well in our communities now that those wars that are supposed to benefit us oftentimes hurt us far worse. And so when we talk about demands, I think the visions of 50 years ago, when I look at the 10-point platform and when I look at...
The 10-point platform of the Black Panther
absolutely.
Party.
And so when I look at the 10-point platform, when I look at the demands of Garvey, when I look at the demands of King and others, we're asking for the same things. And so to me, the question becomes, how do we move forward with the ask? I don't think we can continue to ask in the same ways that we have been asking.
Well, I don't see, I see a little different because I don't think we ever asked. I mean, I think the word ask was, you know, just a polite way of saying before we burn down this. I mean, really, people were saying, I'm asking you, but, or they would say, I'm axing you, but nobody thought that they were just asking by that time, yeah. right? But there was a hope that, like, just for a minute, if you asked me in 1965, 66, 67, when I was living in Newark, New Jersey, in the black community, in 68, the rebellion happened. The National Guard comes down the street. I later on read the Kerner Commission report, and they were talking about all these people that were shot by National Guardsmen who were just sort of sitting in their living rooms or sitting on their porch. And I went, and I walked down a cold sweat because we were at 212 Chadwick Avenue, and these stormtroopers started coming in their jeeps, and we were just sort of sitting on the porch. And the next thing they knew, they pulled guns, they pulled rifles on us and said, if you don't get back in there, you're dead. And we went running into, you know, back into the thing. Okay, so what's the point? If you still asked us what we wanted in 67, 68, what did the Black Power Movement want? As you said, the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party said, you know, I should know it better, but, you know, we need food, we need housing, we need land, we need an end to police brutality, we do not want to fight in your wars, you can tell me others. But there really was still a belief that if we were radical enough and revolutionary enough, we could force the system to do things. I don't think that anymore. And that's different from asking. I'm saying I don't even know if we can't seem to reform the system through revolution, and I want you to get concrete about Skid Row. Like, if right now the system came to you and said, all right, Pete, you got us. Tell me what it would look like.
So, let me be clear. First of all, when I talk about Skid Row, I'm talking about Skid Row. I'm talking about South Central. I'm right. talking about Washington, D.C. I think, and I love it when I'm on front lines because you and I, we can go for a long time, and hopefully the listeners like listening to us as we go for a long time. I mean, you brought up the Kerner Report, and I think that is an important document. I think one of the things that resonated with me in the Kerner Report is when it highlighted why It highlighted why the activities on the ground were happening and by whom, right? And this is important. This part is important. The Kerner report said it happened by young people, teenagers, because they had a heightened sense of racial pride. We have to think about what was going on culturally at that moment. We have got to think about poetry. We have got to think about the music, the songs, the writings, the artistry. The movement was alive. And then when we talk about asking versus demands, I don't think it's a proposition of asking versus demands, because I think a lot of things were happening. I think there are some folks who were asking, right? But then I also know that there were a whole lot of people in the streets demanding in their particular ways. And I think it was a confluence of both of those things that led to the meager changes that we have recognized. I mean, I got to think about H.R.A.P. Brown. I got to think about Burn Baby Burn. I got to understand that it was those things connected to some of the more passive asking that really led to the shift or the changes. I think the bigger part of the proposition is, after we moved it a bit, what was the response of the system? Well, we know the response of the system.
What was it?
Well, the response of the system really was the criminalizing of political activity. We saw the development of prison booms. We saw a shift from things that were basically misdemeanor acts turned into felonies. So we saw this whole shift to harness or criminalize a generation and a movement to stop them from moving forward with the ask or the demand that we're talking about.
Well, I just finished at least a draft of an article called A Black Revolution is in Our Future, and you're listening to Pete White from the Los Angeles Community Action Network and from many other revolutionary organizations he'll tell us about at some point in his past life. And this is Eric Mann from the Labor Community Strategy Center and the Congress of Racial Equality and the Students for Democratic Society and a close friend of the Black Panther Party and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. One of the things I was thinking about, Pete, is that I completely agree with you that I think, let me just take a minute with our listeners here. In 1968, the urban rebellion was kicked off because a cabbie named, of all things, John Smith, like every man, you know, black cabbie, of course, was beaten in front of everybody and the city burned down. The 1992 rebellion in L.A. was because of police brutality on Rodney King. When they did the, I think, a study of 120 rebellions, almost every one from the murder of King was about police violence against black people. It wasn't urban fights over housing. It wasn't about lack of jobs, even though those were all part of what went burning. But it was a direct attack of the police on the people. So when we started making these demands about stopping the mass incarceration of black people, there were 200,000 people in U.S. prisons, which we thought was the most insane number of people in prison we ever heard of. And now, of course, there's 2.5 million people, a million of whom are black. So I've been trying to think of, you know, and maybe this is obvious, but there's a lot of things being said, like, well, black people are surplus labor, so they don't know what to do with it. It was a right-wing effort to just get white voters up, you know, all excited. I think it was a very explicit, as you have said, counter-revolutionary plan to say black people play a very unique role in U.S. society. They are the revolutionary agent, not the only one, but they've been the driving one for every other oppressed nationality, for every other force. We have to punish this community for all that it's done to us in the war in Vietnam, where they wouldn't fight, all they've done with us to take on the police. We're going to basically go back and become an occupying army inside. And we used occupying army. It's not like that was a new concept, but I'm saying there's been an exponential expansion of the occupying army and the keeping black people down as a political suppression seems to me the driving force for the mass incarceration. And just one more thing that I've been listening to a lot of people saying, you know, we say to ourselves, you know, counselors, not cops, schools, not jails. But here's the problem. They want jails. They don't want schools. So you can't say you're making a bad choice. You know, have someone do, do you know what costs more to lock up a black man and give him a college? And they're going, yeah, you think we don't know that? You think that's new information? But we don't want the black man to go to college. We do want the black man to go to jail. Do you think that's a fair political assessment? And how would you address it or elaborate it.
So I believe, yes. I think that's a fair political assessment. But I also don't want the listeners to think that we are exercising a game of oppression Olympics, right? People should know that it is important not to speak in universal terms all the time.
You talking about me?
Nah, shit. Well, you know, I'm definitely not talking about you because you're not putting it out there. But I want us to have our listeners understand sort of where we're going. I mean, the evidence is clear. So there's a psychologist that speaks about the scales of desirability, right? And it starts from, and this is about people in the United States. And so on one side, it speaks to people who are well-liked, right, on right. one side of the scale. And then on the other side of the scale, it speaks of those who are despised. Right next to despised is exploited people. So it's all about social stratification, right? And when you read the scale, it's very interesting because, of course, on the far right-hand side of the scale, despised is synonymous with black people. But then right to the left of them are my Latino brothers and sisters who are exploited. What's important to note, however, when you think about the difference between despised and exploited, exploited means you have something we want that we're going to take. Despised means we will rob you of everything. We want you dead. And so, and yes, to me, yeah. when we talk about death, it's a spiritual death, it's an economic death, and it's a physical death, right? And we can see that that's the trajectory that we're on. I agree with you 100%. We're sitting around here scratching our heads as if it isn't a plan to lock people up as opposed to educating them. A young doctor at USC, well, actually, he came out of Berkeley.
You're listening to, by the way, the voice you're hearing is Pete White of the Los Angeles Community Action Network. Go ahead, Pete.
And so he said this in a panel, and I'll never forget it. He said, broken systems are systems that you can measure, right? You can measure. You know the outcomes. You can measure and evaluate to say the system is broken. He said, right? And so now when you think about it, we using that definition of a broken system and a broken structure from the chair I'm sitting in with you, Eric Mann, on Front Lines, to some, this system is definitely not broken because they can measure all of the harmful outcomes that are being produced. And so in the same way that people say, why don't we just build more classrooms instead of prison cells? It's very clear the other side knows that this system is operational and not broken because they understand the outcomes.
I think that's really good. Where I think we want to go now, just for a minute, I just want to stay one more on the issue of systematic punishment, and then we are going to move to the issue of gun violence. On the webinar today, Sharon Davies, right, a professor at The Ohio State University and with the Kerwin Institute, was doing a lot of work around attitudes, and I do want to come back to the issue of being a despised people. But there was a picture of a 5-year-old black child crying as the police were handcuffing her. And having a 4-year-old granddaughter and a 7-year-old granddaughter, and it almost had the effect of that seeing that child with napalm on her back in Vietnam. Like, what in the world has happened to this country that you actually think that a child having a temper tantrum, a black child, is going to get handcuffed? Now, in the work we're doing in Los Angeles, we're coming out with a report on a lot of the problems of profound racial, not just discrimination, but suppression inside the schools. Just want to read you a couple of statistics, Pete, that and our listeners. It says numbers of tickets and arrests in the year. 6-year-old one, 7-year-old one, 8-year-old one, 9-year-old 5, 10-year-old 10. Did you say the thing about going from cute to dangerous? Was that your formulation?
Yeah, that's me.
That was you? Well, did you go, you said 10 to 11, you go from cute to dangerous. 10 tickets at 10 and 205 tickets at 11. 698 tickets by the time you're 12. 1,500 tickets by the time the black child, mainly the black boy and Latino boy, is 13. Then 14, it goes up to 1,800. 15, it goes to 1,900. And then at 16 and 17, it stays pretty stable. So basically, just again, a 6-year-old child was either given a ticket or arrested, a 7-year-old child, an 8-year-old child, not 5 9-year-old children, 10 10-year-old children, 205 11-year-old black or Latino children. What can this be besides literally trying to destroy the childhood?
Yeah, I think Eric, it's destroying the childhood, but it's also destroying the family. I mean, when you think about, so listeners, I'm sure, are very well aware that when we're talking about these tickets, if you can't pay those tickets go into warrant. And then they have incredible fines. And so if you have a if you're a child and you're under 18, where do you think those fines are going? And who do you think is going to assume that debt? And who's going to assume that financial responsibility? It's going to be the parents in the household as well. And we know that the parents in the household can't take on another burden. They can't take on a $600 warrant. And then once they get to court, all of the court fees. And so we have got to look at it not only as the attacking of the children, but it's the attacking of the entire family and the attacking of an entire community. And I think just quickly, it's also what Dr. Clyde Woods, rest in peace, good doctor, talked about, the process of asset stripping. It's where police contact begins to take away the opportunities and the potential you may have. Now, when I was growing up, I've been stopped by the police as an adult and a kid hundreds of times, right? But when I was growing up, you couldn't find all of those stops. Now, all of the stops, guilty or innocent, are recorded somewhere. They're on an internet, and they're going to have a bad impact on you moving forward. And so this process of asset stripping becomes quite clear.
Well, the thing that we're saying, and again, you're listening to Eat White, and Pete's been involved in the movement for a long time. We are going to not just keep hinting at your background. I'm going to ask you a little bit about it. But, you know, in this article, I've been reading a book called Blacks In and Out of the Left by this guy, William C. Dawson. I was talked to you about it, Pete, and I also talked to my friend Robin Kelly. And it would be very interesting to sort of document every single aspect of what counterinsurgency looks like. You know, like you take a black family, they just come out of the womb, you know, and theoretically with no societal structures. And then how quick does malnutrition begin, or how quick does the cold or the heat in the apartment, or how many people in the apartment, or who lost their job first? And is there anything good going to happen to that family? Most likely not. So here's, on the other hand, as an organizer, I want to ask you about. Now, we are going to get to the issue of gun violence.
This is Frontlines.
This is Frontlines. You're on Voices from the Frontlines with Pete White and Eric Mann. I want to just talk about this issue of police stop. And do you think, what's it going to take to get the black middle class more angry about their own police experience? Let me just take that a minute. At the film Fruitvale Station, about the murder of Oscar Grant, a lot of artists and writers and producers were there and everything. And each person said, not only did Oscar Grant have this, but you're not going to believe it. They would go, this happened to me. As if this was, you know, I'm saying, well, I went to USC film school, and you're not going to believe it. It happened to me, so I can really empathize. I'm going, no, it's not. It happened to you. Because, I mean, you know what I mean? So why are you so shocked? Instead of, why aren't you more angry? And why don't you see that as, like you said, you've been pulled over hundreds of times. How many black people have not been pulled over?
Right.
And how can that, let me get to the point. You know how William Junius Williams, is that his name, Julius, talks about the underclass as if it's some strange little group of people under a class? But given the role of national oppression right now, do you think that the widespread policing of anyone who is black has revolutionary potential?
The answer to that is yes. I mean, if history is our teacher, it's a resounding yes. I think you asked the question, why is it more middle-class blacks aren't moving out? Let me be very clear. Middle-class blacks are well aware, as you said, of the experience of racial profiling and being over-policed. However, middle-class blacks also have to come to the realization when they stand in front of the mirror every day that this idea of meritocracy was a lie for them as well as everyone else. And sometimes it takes, you know, a rude slapping in the face a few times to make that happen. I think the murder of a 107-year-old Arkansas man by SWAT is one of those things, and this just happened over the weekend, is one of those things that make even middle-class black and all folks say, where are we going? I think the murder of the young man from Florida State who wrecked his car and knocked on a door for help and was gunned down is the type of thing that makes everyone, middle class, below middle class, black folks say, all right, wait a second, it is time to move out. I think as an organizer, and you know this all too well, I think it's going to be our job to figure out where they can place that anger, where they can place that passion. I think that is where we have fallen short. I think there's a lot of anger. People just don't know what to do with it.
You listen to Pete White, and this is Eric Mann. Is Jennifer Kaiser? She's on the case. We're at 818-985-5735. Pete and I are at a bar down the street. We're actually not in the studio, and we just want you to come over and talk to us, actually. And we're just being, in fact, the FBI is taping us, and that's how you're hearing it. See, it's not even on the studio itself. So if you overheard the conversation, because we didn't know we were on the air, and you want to talk to us, call us at 818-985-5735, and here's some questions I'd like to ask you. Have you ever been stopped by the police? Obviously, we're mainly talking about black and Latino listeners, but, and secondly, given that there is some violence in low-income black and Latino communities, which do you think, honestly, not theoretically, is more dangerous to you viscerally, the violence of the oppressed or the violence of the police? And if you can do it fast, do you want the right to bear arms, or would you like the community disarmed? Please don't call from Malibu to tell us your opinion. Sure, you have a terrific opinion, but we would really like our South LA and East LA and East Valley folks to give us a call and talk about their own experience. So, Pete, as we're waiting for the calls, tell us a little bit about your background. I mean, obviously, you do have a tremendous historical scope, which we're trying to talk to these younger people about. Tell us a little bit about your own consciousness-raising process.
So, I'm a native of South Central Los Angeles. It's interesting. I was in a meeting with the city attorney, and I said South Central Los Angeles, and he attempted to correct me, which was kind of odd. But it's interesting. I'm a product of the first generation of hip hop, which I always put out there, which is very, very important in my development. But the other thing that's important to note, I was raised on the East Side. So for the real LA natives, you know what I'm talking about. I was raised first on 28th and Hooper, right on the East Side, right down the street from Central Avenue Jazz. Now, I'm not old enough to have seen Central Avenue Jazz, but I saw the small clubs, and I play music as well. But also, I'm coming up in an era right on the backside of the Black Power movement. And so it was that energy that was instructive to my formation, right? And so the older cats in my neighborhood when I was growing up, no matter what they were doing, street-oriented cat, they could see in me sort of these riches or these goals, right? And they would tell me things, and they would instruct me about how not to do what they were doing. And it was interesting to me coming to age on the backside of the Black Power movement was that these cats, not only were they instructing me, but they were giving me political development. Right. They were telling me what I needed to listen to. I was listening to the Watts Prophets. I was listening to Gil Scott-Heron when I was coming up, in addition to It's Like That, What, and That's the Way It Is. Right. And so my entire development politically and culturally was handed to me. And so when I look at you, I'm looking at you, or I'm speaking to you through the voices and the ethos of an entire generation of cats who had been involved in the struggle and were still street-oriented cats dealing with everyday life of trying to feed their families. And that's the short story, because we know the feds are listening. If you want to hear the rest, you're going to have to come join us down the street at the bar.
Okay. 8:05. Looks like some people want to talk to us. Hey, Patrick from Bellflower. Tell us about your own experience.
How you gentlemen doing today?
All right, glad to have you, Patrick.
Thanks.
Good. I just caught you guys. I was just surfing the channels there and found your conversation. I thought it was pretty interesting. The gentleman that was just speaking now, he was raised in Los Angeles. I have a question for him.
I'm here.
Your friends there, they were guiding you. Were your parents around?
Yes, they were.
They're giving you guidance?
Yes, they were. I'm definitely, Brother Patrick, I'm a mama's boy, but my parents were around. My pops, you know, as many pops were, at that time, he was out providing. So fishing trips never did that, but they were around.
Okay, yeah, I was just asking that because my point in calling is that, you know, it's parenting, in my opinion. A lot of it's parenting. And I know we're profiled. I've been profiled. I'm Mexican-American, grew up in Linwood, profiled many times. My parents weren't all that. They weren't great parents. My older brothers got into some gang activity, and I saw their stupidity and decided not to go that route. And my parents, too, were busy, you know, providing for us, too, you know. But a lot of these families now, especially the young Mexican-American families, they really don't have the values to send their kids properly.
Patrick, listen to this, Patrick. I got to ask you a question. This is Eric Mann, because I got to get another guest on. If you would have a choice between the right to bear arms and have more people in South LA legally able to bear arms or to have your community dramatically disarmed, which one would you prefer?
Okay, so for me to bear arms or for people to just disrespect us, is that what you're asking me?
Would you rather have more people in your community with the right to bear arms, or would you rather have essentially the police disarming the community on the theory there would be less violence? You got to get right to the answer, though.
I think that, you know what, if you're a respectful person and you can handle the situation of having an arm, you know, a weapon, and be a responsible person, then great, more power to you. No, I don't think that it's not a right. I think it is the right of us.
You know, thank you so much.
Americans have an arm. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Rob. Thurston in Long Beach.
Hello.
Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines.
Good day to you all, both.
Sure. How are you, Thurston?
I'm very fine. Yes, I was raised in Long Beach. I had many relatives in South Central. My grandparents were in South Central, Watts, and the surrounding area of Compton. So I'm very familiar. I'm 52 years old. I'm very familiar with conspiracies. I'm a writer. When it comes down to the primary question which you posed, the alleviating of guns is never going to happen in this country. People are going to always hang on to their guns. So disarming is a non-issue. The fact is that people have guns right now, and having them turn over, the criminals always keep their guns, unfortunately. So that's not a... Hello?
Yeah.
We're still here.
Thurston, let me ask you this question.
My phone's beeping. I'm calling on my cell. I probably have a business call coming in, but...
Now, let me ask you this question. Do you think that the reduction of police guns is something that's hot? In other words, do you want less or more police in your community?
It needs to be more policing the guns that kill. I do believe that assault weapons don't belong in the hands of a common person. They should have extensive training in order to get a high-powered firearm. And it shouldn't just be a background check. It should be a full psychological profiling and a weapons training course to have anything over 9mm.
Thank you so much.
Range.
Thanks a lot for your opinion.
Let me just jump in real quick.
Come on, Pete.
My good friend Eric, we were talking yesterday, and he said straight out to the question or the response of Thurston, he was like, you know what? White folks with AK-47s aren't interested in shooting animals or shooting deers with those AK-47s, just to highlight Thurston's point. I agree with that.
Glad you liked it. But yeah, because Obama keeps saying, you don't need an AK-47 to shoot a deer. And the white people are saying, what makes you think I want to shoot a deer? You know? Ralph in Los Angeles, tell us about the police, disarmament, and guns. Okay, we're moving on to Gary in Oxnard. All right, does anybody want to talk to us besides me and Pete?
Because we can keep talking,
y'all. I'm just going to say, we don't need y'all to call, so we're fine. Don't interrupt our conversation. In fact, we were doing fine here. Hey, Ralph, are you around? Robert in L.A.
No, I think they're gone. I think we should just keep on talking
That's right.
And encourage the telephone calls.
Yeah, Jennifer, if you get any calls,
let us know.
Let us know. All right, Chris from Pomona.
How you doing?
We're happy to have you. This is Eric and Pete on Voices from the Frontlines.
How you hearing, man? How you doing? I'm from Pomona. We've had a rash of violence here. So, as far as your question, I think we have the right to bear arms. I don't think that should be taken away. But I also think that, the police do need a little bit more assistance. And as far as getting it seems to me that right now everything is either drug influenced or gang provoked. It's just because I'm a boxing coach. I see it front and center, you know, and there has to be more social programs. And I see that we lack that. We used to have social programs in Pomona. We don't have that no more, man. It's gone. So since it's gone, you got more kids on the streets and guys like us trying to get them off, but there's only a few of us trying to change these kids' minds and give them some goals. But I don't see that like I used to see when I was growing up in the 90s. There was social programs for us back then, a little bit at least, and actually they were getting taken away in the 80s and the 70s, and I just got a little bit of it, but I'm not seeing any of that now. It's gone.
Well, when I was involved, and I'll get to Pete in a minute, when I was involved in Newark again in 1968-69, was a period of really rising government programs, and I was working with a lot of young, you know, black youth. If a young man had a speech impediment, I could find a speech therapist for free from government programs. If a kid had diabetes, I'd get on the phone, I'd find a really great community doctor. And when we keep hearing, well, we cut this program only by 6%, we cut this year by 4%, these programs have names. They are the gym that you lost. They are, you know, I mean, they are the community centers. They are the public health centers. So you're right. They've cut the public safety net, and these kids are out on their own. Pete, you want to just take it for a minute?
Yeah, I just want to take it for a minute. First of all, man, I appreciate the call from the Tri-City area, first and foremost, brother. And I will say to you, just lending from a conversation Dr. Robin Kelly and myself had, that what we're really talking about are violent economies, and the need to starve the gun culture. One of the ways that we begin to starve the gun culture is to replace those programs, is to fully invest in our communities, right? Is to invest in programs like yours and make sure that we can build communities that thrive. But we have got.
I'm doing it all by myself. I don't get no government funding. I have a gym in Laverne that I run all by myself with my own money. I'm a termite inspector by day and a boxing coach by night, man. I do it for the kids, and I only do it that way because there's no other way to do it. I'm going to get a 501c3 together, but that still costs $1,800, man. So it's just a lot of work to put everything together, and I don't see anybody helping us, and it's really frustrating. Because there's a lot of good things out there if people were to invest in people like me and other social things, you know. I would say another thing, arts programs and stuff like that. I mean, those things need to be music. All those things need to be pushed in our communities, and it's not.
Well, listen, I'm going to have to go, but let me say this. I'm serious. You should get in touch with either the Los Angeles Community Action Network or the Labor Community Strategy Center and talk about, because thank you so much for the work you're doing. A lot of people call up with opinions, but you're actually doing something to help the community. And don't feel so alone or so bad. Just say you're doing it. You know what I mean? Just feel positive about it. You're doing it.
Oh, I'm very positive about it.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you so much for your work. Hey, Bianca and Covina, how you doing?
How are you guys doing?
Okay, Bianca, what's up?
Hey, Bianca.
I think they have cameras everywhere except for where they really need them. They need them on those police. I've heard of programs where they have cops wearing some type of surveillance, and I think that would really reduce a lot of the police brutality. I would love to say we should all disarm and hold hands and sing Kumbaya, but it's not going to happen. And I think we should be able to be armed, but just like that other fellow said, we need to, you know, be educated about it, and there needs to be stricter laws as how to get a gun. But I work with at-risk kids, and just like the other guy that just spoke, it's rough out there. There's not a lot of programs that are free, and that's what we need, is free programs for kids to be involved in, because what else do they have, you know?
Well, thank you so much, Bianca. Really glad to have you on the show. Marcy from Inglewood. Hey, Marcy, you on the show?
Yes, hi.
Hey, welcome to Voices. Marcy.
I was calling in to give my comment because I'm kind of putting my hope in the Latino community at this point. I saw something that I never saw before, and that was a Latino police officer, totally cholo. I mean, he had the whole what's up Holmes pose and everything. And when I saw that, I said, things are definitely changing. and he had another Latino brother pulled over, and he really looked like he did not know what to do. But because it was him and an Asian officer and then two Caucasian officers, you know, he was kind of in check. But I said, you know what, give it another 3 years. I want to see where this is going. So I'm kind of putting my hope in the Latino community right now to make change.
All right. Well, that was a very nice story, and thanks for telling us to it. Hey, we got a lot of women on the phone. It's great. Vera from Orange County. How you doing?
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me? We're good, and I'm ready to go. No guns. Get the guns. You know, let's like delete the gun situation, period. That's how I feel. I'm 50-something. I'll be like probably 54 on my next birthday, raised in New York. So I was born in 1958, and my father was a civil rights activist. I'm in Orange County now. I was raised in that. I was expelled from school, profiled just because I had my Black Power button on, and I was like one of those intellectual little kids, you know, studying Huey P. Newton and Nikki Giovanni. I mean, I was just one of those kids, starting clubs, expelled in the sixth grade. Now, cut to the chase, no guns. But, you know, it's the same old, that systematic, you know, of course they don't have any programs, you know, we can't expect that these people have programs for to support, they want guns, they want, you know, anarchy, so, you know, so they can do smoke screens and, you know, 9/11s and all kinds of stuff. No, they want shit wild, wild, wild. They want it wild. And so what we have to do as a community, and we have to do it, is not expect, we don't want corporate backup. You get grassroots. That's how it happens. It gets real creative at times like this. You know, because you see, right now it's off the chain.
Hey, Vera, you're off the chain. So listen, you're really good. And Vera, I knew you from New York. I could tell from the minute you started talking. You know what I'm saying? So I really appreciate you. Okay, hey, Femi. Femi from Lakewood.
So many times here for just.
Okay. Okay, next.
She's definitely ready for the revolution, y'all.
She's ready for the revolution.
We're going to organize in Orange County right through Vera. There it is. Strategy Center South.
Femi from Lakewood.
So I definitely want to say I've never been stopped by the police and been profiled so far. Also, I definitely agree with the last caller. No guns, because in a world where we are viewed to them as a threat, they're scared already. So there will be no type of discussion, no type of emotion. Let me see what he's going through. They're scared of us. So we definitely got to get rid of the guns. I don't think it would ever happen, but yeah. Also wanted to state that Peter White stated either we're going to create or change the world. I definitely agree with that. Either we're going to change what's going on, or we just need to go ahead and then honestly just separate. We need our own Department of Justice, agriculture, things like that, education. It's just not getting better. It's getting worse. And I'm only 32, so I've seen a lot of changes thus far.
Have you ever been involved? Do you want to get involved in organizing? You want to get involved?
I would love that. And that's another thing. That's another thing, too. He said that, you know, we do have a lot of anger. It's a lot of people that want to do things. We just honestly don't have guidance. We don't know where to go. And then if you're also thinking about living and paying your rent and things like that, you get bogged down with a lot of basic needs of life. And it kind of takes you away of what we have to do as a whole. But
no,
I'll definitely be involved.
No, that's right. That's right, Femi. And because I'm an organizer and Eric's an organizer, I'm going to beat him to the punch. So I'm going to say, if you call 213-228-0024, that's the Los Angeles Community Action Network. And we have work to be done. Or you could find us on the web at www.cangress.org. That's like Congress with an A. We took out the O, put
okay.
An A for action.
Okay.
So, Femi,
I could definitely do
Femi,
that.
Femi, you got, listen, since I didn't give you the number, you got to call Pete. Now, if you're going to do this, you better call Pete White.
Look, right.
Is that
look,
a deal?
Repeat it again. It was 213.
228-0024.
And listen, okay. The Los Angeles Community Action Network really needs your help. They're doing amazing work. They're stopping a lot of the police sweeps in Skid Row. They have homeless activists who are totally disciplined and organized, who show up for work like totally dependable and have no home. So it's a terrific group of people, and they're obviously our very close allies. So today's all the revolutionaries today go over to LA Can So Los Angeles Community Action Network, okay? But yes. listen, if you don't show up, we're going to come get you, okay?
Definitely. Thanks, Femi.
All right, we got one more call. Femi, thank you so much. Listen, I want to thank all the sisters calling today. This is terrific. I'm going to go to Marlene in Sherman Oaks. Hi, Marlene. Eric Mann and Pete White.
Hi, I appreciate the show today. I think all the people that are working to try the best to eliminate our problems and to help our society, but I also believe we need to focus and pay people not to have kids, because I don't think it's going to change. I think we're going to keep on having politicians who view kids as throwaway property, and I'm sorry. I wish I could have a more positive note. But
thanks, Marlene. We heard your position.
Anyway.
Okay, hey, Jay from Los Angeles, you get the last word. It's got to be a fast word. Jay?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Jay.
Hear you.
I believe the question was, how do you feel about inner-city crime versus actual more police activity? Am I correct?
Do you want to restrict the police more, or do you want to restrict guns more?
What I want to say is I can actually prevent and deter inner-city crime myself with my personal being, but I can't prevent police from harassing me. If I try to prevent that, it's considered assaulting a police officer. But if someone tried to run up and rob me and I protect myself, it's being a good Samaritan.
Jay, thank you so much. We're going to have to get off the air. We just got the hook. That's why we wanted to get you on. Well, this is really good. We're going to give out the name of the bar next week. But this is Eric Mann, and I've been spending the hour that flew by with my friend and comrade Pete White from the Los Angeles Community Action Network, who even beat me to fame. He was actually... jumped right out of the words out of my mouth. So it's
organizing 101, Eric.
Organizing 101, right? So it's been wonderful having you on the show. We'll be talking to you next Tuesday at 4. We're going to have on Alan Weeder, who's done a book called Ruth First and Joe Slovo in the War Against Apartheid, two Jewish white communists who built the African National Congress. I'll see you next
week. Bye-bye, y'all. Keep listening.
And thank you, Jennifer Kaiser.
Thank you so much.